Welcome to the Scalable Real Estate Investing Podcast, where we discuss the most scalable strategies, tools, and approaches to successfully invest in real estate. Learn how to make the most impact of your time, automate your real estate investing business, find off-market deals with minimum time invested, and leverage your capital to create as many income streams as possible so that you can achieve true financial independence. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Mason Clement. Hi, Scalable Investors. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Scalable Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Mason Clement. And today we have with us Kevin Butt, who is a really big name in real estate. If you haven't already heard of him, he's the host of two different podcasts, the Mobile Home Academy and also the highly rated Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. He is also the founder and CEO of Sunrise Capital Investors, which has a long track record of successfully investing in mobile home parks, parking lots, and other really interesting niche areas of finance of real estate. So I'm really excited to have him on the show. Let's bring him in. All right, Kevin, how's it going today?
Mason, doing great, bud. Thanks for having me here. Looking forward to it.
Sure. Well, really excited to have you. So I think a lot of people are probably familiar with you, but in case they aren't, why don't we just get started on your background and how you got involved in real estate and how it got you to where you are today.
Sure. No, absolutely. Again, thanks for having me here. And I'll try to keep this somewhat short, but I've been a full-time real estate investor practically my entire adult life. So I'm 41 now, and I got introduced to real estate when I was 19. Kind of found me. I wasn't really looking for it. I was looking for something. I just didn't know that real estate was the thing I was looking for, and it kind of sought me out, which I'm incredibly grateful for, because I don't know where I'd be at today, Mason, if it wasn't for real estate. So with that being said, I was introduced to it by a gentleman by the name of David, who David became my mentor, and he was about 25 years older than I, and I met him through a girl I was dating, or basically her mom was dating David, so like it was kind of a random occurrence and introduction that we had, and anyway, became good friends with David, and he was a local real estate investor. He owned a number of single family properties, smaller multifamily properties, and basically lived off the cash flow. I mean, that was his business. He'd been doing it for a long time and, had a very sustainable lifestyle that he built on the cash flow from his rental properties. And it was very interesting to see the type of lifestyle he lived versus what my parents lived. I grew up in a family that never went without, but just very middle of the road, blue collar family, hardworking parents. And again, never went without, but also didn't have a lot of luxury items, didn't go on multiple vacations a year, didn't drive fancy cars, things like that. But in any event, David did. He did all those things. And, he invited me about 4 or 5 months into our friendship. He invited me down to a boot camp in Philadelphia. I was living in Pennsylvania at the time. And it was a real estate boot camp. His partner could not attend with him. And so it was like a $3,000 event. And I'm like, I'll go. Absolutely. I don't know what I'm going for. I don't know what I'm going to learn. But if it gets me any closer, step closer to what it is you do, then I'd love to go check it out. And ultimately, I did that. I attended the boot camp, was overwhelmed, was excited, had all these different emotions rolling through my body. And I came back from that, like a lot of folks do. They go to these events or they take some type of online training and get all jacked up and excited. And then things kind of peter out, a few weeks or a few months down the road. They kind of lose their steam and momentum and go back to their old way of life. And I didn't want that to happen. And so I wanted to do this, but I didn't know the next real logical steps. And so I basically asked Dave, how can I help him in his business? And where could I add value to what he did on a day-to-day basis? And we figured out where those gaps were in his business. And then so in between attending community college and tending bar at night, I basically was either at David's home office, out in the field with him, and doing whatever he needed me to do to, again, help assist him in growing his business and making his life easier. And I did that for about 14 months. I basically followed him around, helped him, was involved in conversations, heard him talk to sellers, buyers, agents, contractors, all those things, and just, was absorbing it all during that period of time, and bought my first property when I was 20. And from that point moving forward, I attempted to emulate David's process, what it was he did. And I learned very quickly, Mason, that with the $7,000 I had saved, I bought my first property, and I leveraged a private lending relationship that David had built over years and that I had come to know over the year or so that I was studying underneath David. And I bought that first property with the intent of keeping it as a rental, used all my $7,000 I'd saved up bartending, and realized pretty quickly that you know, the 200 some odd dollars a month of cash flow, it was going to take a long time to save up enough money to go buy another property. And so what I realized very quickly is that I had to modify my systems or my business slightly from David's in order to build up some capital and, you know, truly be able to hold rental properties and you know, multiple of them and produce income. And so I started basically wholesaling or fixing and flipping a few homes, keeping one. And I kept repeating that process to where I would build up enough cash enough cash in the bank from flipping or wholesaling, and then I'd keep one, do it again, keep one, do it again, keep one, until I got enough momentum and enough capital and enough other relationships outside of my own capital that I could, you know, start building a larger portfolio of rentals. And so I did that for many years, Mason. I did it for about the next 6 years. I worked feverishly to build a fairly large single family home portfolio and started buying some small multifamily as well. And, went through 2008, had some really hard times, and stepped away from real estate for a few years, and then dove back in 2011, late 11, early 12. And that was when I was introduced to mobile home parks. And it was a niche I was not really seeking out. It kind of found me again, just through happenstance, through a relationship, through a lunch meeting that I had with a guy that I was mutual friends with. And He intrigued me enough with his business of investing in mobile home parks that I gave it a shot and ultimately bought our first park in 2012, and haven't looked back since. I mean, I completely got away from the single family stuff. I realized even before the crash of 08 that the single family was just had a lot of inefficiencies. You know, it treated me well up until the crash, and, you know, I had built what I thought was a very legit business. I mean, I was making a lot of money and you know, things seemed to be going great, but all those inefficiencies really reared their ugly head, you know, when 2008 came and a lot of downward pressures were put onto that particular space. And so when I went back into the rebuilding phase in 2011, 2012, I knew that I did not want to invest in single family. I didn't want to rescale. I didn't want to go down that road again. And again, the inefficiencies, it just didn't make sense. And so originally I was going to focus on multifamily because my multifamily properties had treated me really well. And again, it was introduced to mobile home parks, which is it's a variation of multifamily. And it's one I had never considered. And I went and purchased it. I was like, I'm going to go buy a park. I'm going to either approve or disprove this concept or this niche or this asset class. And I did that. And the first one back in 2012, it went really well. We still own it today up in Atlanta, Georgia. Bought a really distressed property and bought a second one. See if I could, you know, basically replicate the, you know, the success that we had. Bought a third one, bought a fourth. Now we own properties in 13 different states. We got about 2,000 lots, 19 communities that we own and manage. And that is our core competency, mobile home parks. And we have a few other niches that we invest in, but mobile home parks is the predominant one. So enough of my rambling. I'll pass it back to you now.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. So what are kind of the comparisons you've seen or similarities or differences between multifamily and mobile home parks? Because I realize there's like septic tanks and other things at a mobile home park you may not have to deal with in multifamily.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just really depends on where the park's located. I mean, I'm sure there's multifamily properties that exist out in rural areas that might be on septic, might be on wells. And so it really comes down to, you know, the location and how close to a city limits or, you know, to public water sources or sewer sources. And so we do own communities that are on, you know, they have either septic systems for the sewage or they have wells for the water. We have a few parks that we own that have wastewater treatment plants, which are basically miniature versions of what a municipality uses to process sewage, you know, raw sewage. And so, and then we have many communities that are on public utilities that are, you know, tied into city water, city sewer. And again, I don't know how many apartments are out there that might be on private sewer or water systems, but I'm sure there are. I'm sure there's plenty of mountain rural parts of the country that are on those types of private systems. So I don't know if there's a big difference there between mobile home parks and multifamily, but I do think it's an area that a lot of lot of new investors in the mobile home park space that it could take you by surprise. There's a lot of additional due diligence, and I'm not going to say a lot of additional risk per se associated with private utilities. There is more risk, but so long as you understand and you can get comfortable with that risk profile and know what you're getting yourselves into, then it shouldn't be that big of a deal. But a lot of folks dive in. They're buying a park that's got private utilities. Could be any different type of makeup, like we talked. You know, well for the water. It could be a septic arrangement to where, you know, maybe the well, maybe the aquifer it's pulling from. You know, they didn't go through the test. They didn't get an engineer involved. They didn't get, you know, do their due diligence in the system, and they come to find out after they buy the park that, you know, maybe the aquifer that it's pulling water from has too much iron in it. And it's a very expensive fix. Either they got to upgrade their equipment to the tune of, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, or drill another well, go down a couple, a couple aquifers deeper to pull some cleaner water. It could be a very expensive endeavor, unexpected, and catch you off guard. And same kind of goes with private sewer systems. It's speaking to septic tanks. Septic tanks, they don't last forever. A lot of these parks out here that you see are, they're 40, 50, 60 years old, and septic tanks are only as good as what goes into them as well, and also as good as the soil that they're in. A lot of folks flush things that they shouldn't down septic tanks, and goes out into the leach field. Leach fields get clogged up, or they break down or fail over time. And so I've seen people step into kind of landmines there as well, to where they just, they think that it's just, Mother Nature's going to do her thing, which is what how a septic system works, but they didn't realize, or they didn't take into account that it's 50 or 60 years old, and that maybe hasn't been kept up, hasn't been maintained as it should have been over the last, 50 or 60 years. And now they've got to replace leach fields and, to the tune of, $4,000 or $5,000 a pop. And they've got lots of them to replace. So in addition to that, while they're replacing, while it's failing, they've got a tenant living there that's calling with major issues because their sewage is backing up into their house, which is not a fun thing to deal with.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, when I bought my current house, primary residence, there was an old cast iron pipe in the backyard, and we had a tenant for the first 6 months that we bought it, and it backed up like within the first week. So I know that issue. It's very obviously like an emergency critical time. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Actually, I listened to one of your episodes on mobile home park investing podcast about RV parks. One of your guests was talking about it. Have you ever purchased one of those?
No, we don't own any strictly RV parks. We do own a number of mobile home parks that have an RV component. So, there might be a handful of lots, or maybe two handfuls of lots of RV spaces in that community. But the residents, for the most part, the resident profile that might occupy those RV lots inside our mobile home community are more long-term residents. So maybe they're in town or working on a project. Maybe it's like a 7 month long project and they need they're traveling with their camper behind them and they're going to live there for 7 months. And so that's more the profile that might fit in our communities. The traditional RV community is much more of a transient crowd. Nothing wrong with that. It's just it's a very different business model than that of a mobile home park. With mobile home parks, you've got stable residents. You've got folks that are, that are going to live there for a year and sometimes, decades. So we've got a few residents throughout our different communities that have, I think our record is like 43 years or something like that a resident has lived inside the one community. And so whereas in an RV park, you've got people that are coming for nightly stays, a few days, maybe a week, maybe a month, maybe a couple months, like down here in Florida, a lot of snowbirds come down and stay for 3-4 months at a time. But again, just a very, very different management style and also business model in general. And so we have not ventured into that space at this point in time.
Okay. Yeah. I think on the episode too, you were talking about there's kind of different types of RV parks as well. So that makes sense. More like long-term stay ones as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like the long-term ones, for example, there are a number of parks here in like Florida and more so the Sunbelt states. And so, Texas, Florida, Arizona, even like Southern California, there's a number of RV parks in those type of locations that they're classified as an RV, they're zoned as an RV, but what you'll find is a majority of the residents are permanent. They're permanent, or maybe they're not physically, their body isn't physically there year round, but they have a unit that stays there year round. And they pay for that unit to stay there year round, but they might only come down to it for 6 or 7 months out of the year. So in that situation, and we don't own one like that, but we've looked at many, and I'm comfortable with that model because they're still, even though they're seasonal residents, they pay year round. And so it's still a very stable business model. In fact, it's sometimes there's benefits to it because you don't have the drain on the infrastructure of your park 12 months out of the year, right? The residents are only there. Maybe it's the wintertime. They come down to Florida. They live there for 6 months and then they go back up north for another 6 months. And so for those other 6 months, your property maybe only has 20% of the residents living there. And they're not being up the roads. They're not being up the, you know, the water and sewer lines. They're not, you know, less wear and tear on the community as a whole.
Okay. Yeah. It's like people paying for gym memberships and just don't use the gym.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. Cool. So why don't we get into more of the other interesting stuff you're doing, like the parking lots.
Yeah.
Cause I know this is a big one for you, at least as you mentioned on your podcast. How do you like evaluate a parking lot deal and what kind of parking lots are you purchasing and all that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah. So up until about a year ago, we only, and for the past 7-8 years, we only focused on mobile home parks. Now, just to, you know, add some additional context there, I've got personal investments as, you know, a limited partner in many different asset classes. So self-storage, which I know that you focus in, Mason. I've got a number of self-storage investments. I've got a number of multifamily investments. I've got a number of medical office investments. Again, all as a limited partner. I like all those asset classes. It's very hard to be an expert in all, right, at the same time. And so we've always been incredibly focused and, you know, want to become the best that we can be in the mobile home park space before even considering venturing into another asset class. And parking lots came on my radar. It's probably been about 4 years now that I was first introduced to the space by a gentleman that I actually had on the podcast. I mean, maybe it's even 5 years. It's been a long time. And, you know, again, just like mobile home parks, it was an asset class I'd never even considered, right? I just never really went down that path, never thought about, you know, owning it as an investment and, you know, the merits behind it, what have you. And in any event, I was always intrigued after that podcast enough to where it never left my brain. And about 2 years ago, my partner and I, we were at the point in our business where, you know, we wanted to start exploring it more. We wanted to, you know, see if we could tack it on to our current business model, which is mobile home parks. Again, it's a land play, right? Very similar to mobile home parks. You're basically renting land. You're renting spaces. It's a different business model, but you're renting spaces just like we do in mobile home parks. And one of the other really attractive features of parking lots is that a couple of big things that really you know, pushed us to hone in on that space even further. One of the big ones was how they're typically managed. Now, there's a number of very large parking lot management companies throughout the country. Some are, you know, local, some are regional, some are nationally publicly traded companies, big groups. They don't own the real estate. They are just management companies. So they're the ones that manage the parking lots. They manage the infrastructure, the payment systems, you know, the credit card systems, merchant systems. They manage parking garages. They're in the business of management, but they're not on the ownership side. And that was really attractive to us because what that means is that if we can buy a parking lot at the right price and not necessarily have to be involved in the day-to-day management and literally have a large operator come in and sign a lease, a long-term fixed lease with us, where that money is guaranteed by, you know, a large group with stable financials, then it's literally a set it and forget it. It's about as close to a set and forget it investment as you could possibly have because, again, we're just basically, we're taking a lease on the property and they manage the day-to-day. They manage all the income, outgo, and just pay us a check each and every month. And so that became very attractive to us. And what we found as we dug deeper is that there is it's a very fragmented marketplace still. Of the 70% of parking lot owners only own one parking asset, meaning that a lot of mom and pops out there, just like in mobile home parks, lots of mom and pops that they've owned a parking lot in, you know, downtown area for, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, a very, very long time. there's still a lot of parking lots out there that have the old infrastructure in place. I'm sure everyone listening has probably seen it before, to where you got to, like, there's a metal box. You got to, like, shove your dollar bill into the metal box. You know, they call them honor boxes, I think is what the industry calls them. But lots of inefficiencies of that model, or there's like a physical parking lot attendant there collecting cash. Guess where half that cash probably goes? Probably in his pocket, probably not in the owner's pocket. Same thing goes with those honor boxes. And so there's lots of inefficiencies in that space that will allow us to basically go in and buy a mismanaged parking lot, just like we buy mismanaged mobile home parks, and then basically hand it off to a national or regional operator that's going to install the technology, install the, you know, the parking enforcement systems and all the things that will allow that asset to now run much more efficiently, all while we basically bought it at its current operations, you know, and with its current financials. So I'll give you an example. We've got a parking lot we're closing here in a few weeks, and it'd been owned for the last decade or a little bit more than a decade by a local doctor. He owns a bunch of other real estate. He just owns a little bit of everything, right? I mean, just, he's got some mobile home parks. He's got some single family rentals. He randomly came across this parking lot that it was a distressed redevelopment play. A bank had taken it back after the last crash happened. The bank took it back, and he bought it as an REO. And he's got a son that, not sure the whole story there, but he's got a son that he needs to basically find work for. And so his son kind of manages this parking lot, and he doesn't manage it all that well. He doesn't do any parking enforcement. They don't have a credit card system set up there. And so it's kind of cash and carry type of business. Well, I know one of the local operators in that area that manage a lot of other parking lots, and I asked him to type up an LOI. You know, what would you lease this for? You know the market, you know all the dynamics of this marketplace and the demand that's here at this location. What would you lease this for? And they came back with an LOI for $72,000 a year. And that current operator, based on their profit and loss statement, they're only making, like, I think it was like $40,000 a year. And that's like them collecting everything. And so this management company, they know that they can do more than 72,000 because they're going to pay us 72,000, right? There's a margin there above that where they make their money. And so basically we're buying this mismanaged property, handing it to a leasing company. They're going to pay us $72,000 a year on a 5-year lease with a 5-year extension. And I don't know what they'll make, but obviously they're going to make more than $72,000 a year, and they're going to manage all the day-to-day. And so we're paying $695 for the parking lot, which based on the current financials is not a great deal. Based on the LOI and this management company stepping in, it's a phenomenal deal. I mean, it's darn near a levered 10 cap or unlevered 10 cap. So in any event, that's things like that exist in the parking space. And there's, inefficient operators out there, local mom and pops that owns things that have a lot of upside potential that isn't being realized today. And then the long-term objective here of the parking lot space is, make cash flow today as a covered land play in a location that will ultimately have a higher and better use at some point in the future, right? If you're buying in downtown central business districts, they're not built, there's no more land, right? It's either a parking lot or it's a building already. Like, that's it. There's not a lot of green space or anything else. So there's a limited supply of land. And the same goes in like tourism driven locations, beach towns, things of that nature, to where, you know, there's only so much land. There's nowhere else to go away from this tourism driven area. And so our long-term goal is to basically own in a very desirable location that ultimately will have a higher and better use at some point in the future. But in the meantime, it actually makes sense as a cash flow investment today. So not being speculative at all. If it's worth something more down the road as a redevelopment, that's icing on the cake. We know that we're making our money today on it, and it's a solid investment based on what we're paying and what we're receiving as a lease. And so that's one of the big things that excites us about the parking lot space. You know, today it's hurting a great deal. A lot of the management companies are struggling because of the coronavirus, right? And so you've got a lot of cities, large cities, New York City, you got Chicago, you got these places that have been shut down for 6-7 months, and it just, there's not the activity that was there, pre-COVID. And so I view that as an opportunity at some point, because there's a lot of parking lot operators out there, or parking lot owners that have debt in their property. And I think that there will be ultimately distress, just like there's going to be in a lot of other asset classes, distress as a result of, you know, the lack of revenue coming in, people aren't driving today, people aren't parking, people aren't going to certain beaches and things like that. So anyway, I'd say that the majority of our efforts at this point, we're still looking at parking. We're buying one here shortly. You know, we're looking for, if an opportunity presents itself, we'll buy it. But right now it's a little challenging because a lot of the management companies, they don't want to enter into a new long-term lease without, you know, with all the unknowns, you know, in front of them. And so we're kind of, you know, tiptoeing around, just looking for the killer opportunities. But most of our emphasis and energy at this time, as we record this, is on the mobile home park space.
Okay. So you said long-term lease. What is like a normal lease? Is it like 10 years and now they want to do 1 year?
Yeah. So the one, the parking lot we're about to close on, they actually wanted to do a 10-year. The management company did, and we didn't. And there's a reason behind that. You know, I personally feel that where this is located and the corner, it's on a hard corner, signalized intersection in a thriving downtown area. It's on like one of the main streets in the downtown area. It's already got air rights to go up 35 feet. Again, we're not speculative investors, but also what I don't want to do, if I sign a 10-year lease, I'm basically, it's safety, but it's also a risk in that I think that the demand for development could be there sooner than 10 years. And so I don't want to be locked into a long-term expensive lease that it's hard to get out of. And what I do know is that at the 5-year mark, there's still going to be a demand for parking in that location. So to get that operator to sign another extension for 5 years, I don't think will be all that challenging. You know, I think they've been managing a long time in that area. They know that there's a huge demand for parking and they've done really well there. And so I think that we'll be able to collectively make a smart investment decision at the year 5 mark, either to sign another one or hold off. Maybe we just go month to month, or maybe we could do a year at a time at that point and not tie ourselves up longer and then potentially redevelop it. So, yeah.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And then to increase the income from like that 40,000 to over 72, are these operators increasing the marketing or what are their strategies usually?
There's no proof of this, but I would say that some of the revenue that parking lot's producing today is probably going in that son's pocket. Again, I don't know him personally, so I'm just making assumptions based on my conversations with this operator, the management company, what they do in some of their other lots, a very similar size. The property should be doing better than what it is right now, even though they don't accept credit cards, they don't have parking enforcement, you know, it should be doing better. So more than likely some of that revenue, it's coming in, it's just not going to the bank account. It's going somewhere else. And then in addition to that, it's not necessarily a marketing thing because it's right in the heart of downtown. I mean, it's there in your face. They put some signage up, but like, there's not like paid marketing above just signage on that lot, letting people know that parking's available here. But they'll install, you know, a credit card machine, payment machines there. And then they'll enforce parking, right? For those that have maybe, I'm sure there's probably, the sun's supposed to be enforcing parking now, but I guarantee there's people that park there for free, you know, days at a time that actually don't pay. And so they've got a parking enforcement there locally. So they'll make sure that not even, you know, through technology, they've got parking enforcement. They have actually a physical presence as well. They've got people to go around that will, you know, write tickets, what have you. And so just a lot of efficiencies. Really, it's more efficiencies than anything else. You know, I don't carry cash on me. Very rarely do I carry cash on me. If I'm traveling and like, you know, on a business trip or on vacation or something like that, I'll have some cash just for unexpected events. But here locally, I very rarely ever have cash. So if I ended up going to a parking lot that you only took cash and wouldn't take a credit card, and there was one down the road that took a credit card, guess where I'm going to go park? It's just out of necessity. I don't carry cash. I like using my credit card. I feel safer with just using a credit card. And so I think they're losing a lot of revenue of people just like me that only have credit cards on them. They don't have cash with them. So.
Okay. It makes a lot of sense. I actually lived in New York for 6 years. And mm-hmm. when I was going to Chinatown, that was the only time I made sure I had like $50 cash at least. Because only awkward places like that, these Chinese store owners like cash only. I'm trying to avoid taxes here. Let me only take cash. Yeah.
Exactly.
So. That makes a lot of sense, but it actually reminds me of a parking lot by like Canal and Hester Street, if you're familiar with different Chinatown intersections. Mm-hmm. Way too detailed, I don't know, but they have it's kind of like a vending machine, but for cars, and they like stack the cars.
Yep.
Do you ever use those, or do you ever use like parking garages, or is it just purely open single level parking?
That's a great question. We don't have anything elaborate like that. I mean, I know folks that do. And so it's just in very, you know, New York City, Manhattan is probably that, and in certain parts of Chicago is where you're going to see those type of operations where literally they are so limited and there's such a demand. Like they literally have to create operations where they stack cars on top of one another, things of that nature. But we don't have anything like that. And then as far as the parking garages, we do not own any parking garages, but we will buy parking garages. And so we just haven't found any that have met our, you know, our criteria overall. You know, the parking garage is a different animal. Now you're talking about, you know, an actual, there's a physical building there. You know, a lot of parking garages are older, you know, the ceiling height back when they built it in the 70s might not be conducive now to, you know, half the cars that are on the road, right? You got like pickup trucks and things of that nature that might exceed that height limit. And so there's lots of factors that are involved with a parking garage that don't really come into play or aren't a barrier when you're speaking about just a surface parking lot. And so ideally surface parking lots, in my opinion, they're easy. They're straightforward. There's not a lot of upkeep. I mean, you got an asphalt parking lot that will have some potholes here and there that might need the, you know, the lines restriped. But other than that, there's just really nothing else going on with it. It's easy and simple. And so at some point we'll own parking garages, but today it's simply surface parking lots.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And, it might be a silly question, but have you ever run into any zoning issues either with parking lots or mobile home parks or other things?
With parking lots, no. I mean, you know, in anything that we look at, it's already zoned or approved to be operated as a parking lot. And so it's never been an issue there. As far as mobile home parks, it is something that we do during due diligence where we, you know, just want to ensure that, you know, the current zoning supports the use of a mobile home park. And, you know, what you'll find in mobile home parks is that back when a lot of these were built, there wasn't really a zoning ordinance that even existed. And you'll find that a lot of mobile home parks are not currently zoned as a mobile home park. They might be zoned one of many things. Could be general commercial, could be residential, could be industrial, you know, just a ton of different, you know, underlying zonings that truly don't recognize mobile home parks. But back when they were built, they were essentially grandfathered in. Whenever the zoning ordinance changed, or it was updated, they became grandfathered in. So what you have to make sure of is when you're buying a park that if it doesn't have a true mobile home park underlying zoning, that, you know, that it's protected by, you know, a grandfathered status and that it's actually got a legitimate license to be operated as a mobile home park. But even more specifically, you know, for example, if you're buying a 100 space mobile home park, make sure that it's licensed to have all 100 lots. I've run across many situations where, you know, you see parks that are just, again, random example, 100 lots, but it was only ever licensed for 93, you know, and maybe there was room for seven more. That owner went and put seven more in without getting approval, but the city's not, if they ever found out, they would, you know, make him take those away. And, you know, ultimately, if you're buying it based on cash flow and revenues and you're underwriting it based on 100 occupied, and seven get taken away at some point in time, that's going to change your numbers fairly significantly. So just little things like that you have to watch out for.
Okay. Yeah, I just asked because I'm currently working on a storage deal where frustratingly the owners, they've owned it for like, it's like two different sellers and they've owned it for over 10 years and they just weren't aware that you have to file a certificate of occupancy upon change of ownership. So they were never grandfathered in and they're zoned as C1. Like commercial retail and not actual storage. And so if I was to buy these, it's like a lot of wrinkles to work out with the city just to get it zoned properly. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's maybe just, hopefully it's just like a one-off issue and I don't keep running into this.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and that's where a good attorney comes into play. You know, we don't make guesses at these things when they pop up. You know, we get attorneys involved that are well-versed on, you know, for mobile home parks that are well-versed in our space, that understand the laws, you know, as they apply to that particular state. And every state operates a little differently than the next. And so it's just incredibly important to have the strong, you know, well-versed legal counsel on your side and make sure that they actually understand your space, that they're just a general real estate attorney and they've never dealt with self-storage issues or mobile home park issues, you probably can find a better fit, you know, someone that's actually dealt in your space, because there's unique nuances that exist in each one of these asset classes that we're talking about. And it's good to have someone that's been there and done that.
Okay. Yeah. And also I found it really depends on the city and how ambitious mm-hmm. they are in trying to revive the way that the city looks and all this. So you go to the neighboring town, they don't have those issues. So
right.
It's kind of silly. okay. Well, just thinking here what else we got going. So I know you're syndicating deals for Sunrise. How would you suggest someone kind of break down one of these deals, whether it's your deal or some other deal they're looking at? Like, how would they vet the sponsor and then get comfortable with that if, say, it's their first time investing in a deal?
Yeah, you mean if they're like a limited partner, they're coming in as like an LP, they want to put money into a space? Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it's one I think that needs to be asked more often. And I see a lot of investors just kind of haphazardly investing because of pretty marketing material or something like that. But you've worked really hard for your money, you know, whatever you've done to make your living, you've worked hard for that money. You want to reinvest it, not just in the appropriate asset class, but I think even way more important than the asset class is the sponsor is, you know, who are they? What's their track record? How long they've been doing it? Do they have not just one proof of concept, but multiple proofs of concept where they've, you know, not just made money in the last 3 years, but you know, how did they fare during the downturn? Were they investing before that? What are their core values even? You know, do they align with you and your core values? And you know, just very important things such as that. But really, it comes down to the sponsor first. The asset class or the deal itself is really second to the sponsor. You want to make sure they've got capital, right? I mean, do they have, you know, only a couple thousand dollars in the bank account, but yet they're going out raising a couple million dollars, right? What happens when they run into troubled waters? And it occurs, right? There's never a deal. Of all the deals that we've bought, we'll talk to the mobile home park. So we've owned now, I think, 28 or 29 in total. We've got 19 at present, but every single one of those deals, we go into it, we underwrite it, and we do our best. Underwriting is just the best guess as to how that thing is going to perform, and you learn more as you go forward. So when I underwrite a deal today, I can promise you I'm probably better than what I was 8 years ago when I underwrote a mobile home park, and I'm only going to continue to get better, but it's never perfect. There's never a point in time to where I've underwritten a property, we bought it a year down the road. It's never exactly how I underwrote. It's either doing better, it's exceeded our expectations for factors or variables that we didn't know existed, or it's done worse. It hasn't done as well as what we had anticipated for, again, factors that are unknown. It could be market driven, it could be resident driven, it could be many things, right? And so that's where the sponsor really comes into play. How does that sponsor manage when it does better than expected? That's not a problem. But when it does worse than expected, you know, are they going to be around? Are they going to stick around? Do they have the capital to carry this through without doing capital calls? A lot of sponsors only get paid if the property does either meets expectations or exceeds them, right? A lot of sponsors will not make money. Like if it's not performing as it should and it goes that way for long enough, all their potential future profits get diluted. And at some point in time, they could just literally be working for free on that particular property. And so do they throw in the towel or do they stick through it? Do they have the wherewithal and the financial capacity to stick through it and the morals, you know, the moral compass to stick with it because a lot of their investors trust in them. So things like that are incredibly important. And again, it all comes down to the sponsor and asset class becomes second to that. And as far as how you vet them, again, look at the track record, you know, get proof. Don't just ask, but ask, you know, like literally get details on properties that they've owned, ones they've gone full cycle on. Talk to some of the other investors that have invested with that individual, you know, ask for references that you want to get on the phone and talk to another investor that's invested in other deals with them, that's been with them maybe for a couple of years. I know a limited partner that goes as far as I don't know what service he uses, but he does like a background check on the sponsors before he invests with them to ensure that they don't have a criminal record, right? They weren't in jail for money laundering or something like that, or in prison 10 years ago for money laundering. He wants to know that they've got a, you know, squeaky clean background. So it depends on how far you want to take it, but again, just some food for thought there as far as how to vet someone you're considering investing with.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I try to ask a few different, a handful of guests just to get different perspectives. So mm-hmm. I think that's definitely a common denominator looking at that track record. And my last guest, actually, they're winding down Realty Shares, and it's like over $1 billion of investments, and some of the sponsors just disappeared when things went wrong. So having to litigate against them and stuff is very interesting. So you're really seeing the other side of the coin there. So
yeah, no, absolutely. And even, you know, one thing that you're going to learn from past investors or investors that have been with a sponsor for a period of time is, you know, it's the acquisition side of this business is the sexy part of it, right? Raising capital, buying properties, that's the sexy part. But the operational side, the ugly side of things, like the not so fun part of the business, that's where you separate the good from the bad. And not even just the sheer operations, but the communication that goes along with those operations. How is that sponsor? How do they communicate with their investors, both with good news and bad news? How often do they communicate? What's their method of communication? Do they go very in depth? I mean, do they provide, you know, all the intricate details of the investment? Again, the good and the bad, right? And that will tell you a lot as well. Like, how open are they with their communications? And one of the things that I think sets us apart a little bit, and I'm sure others are doing it now, but, you know, we decided a couple of years back that in addition to our quarterly reports, which are fairly thorough, in addition to that quarterly report, we do a monthly private podcast that we upload into our investor portal for all of our current investors. And so basically that monthly podcast is a much more of a 10,000 foot view, but basically keeps them in the loop. So not just on a quarterly basis, but they know what's going on in between those quarterly reports and quarterly updates. And so again, it's just, you know, telling them what's good and telling them what's bad, you know, not hiding any of the unfortunate news, because it's important. They're ultimately going to learn about it in the quarterly report. And so we want to make sure that they're prepared and we're setting expectations appropriately. So that's one of the unique things I think we do. And I'm sure others do other things that set them apart, but communication is so important. It's just so vitally important in this business.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that bad news does not age well. So it makes a lot of sense. Okay. And it's interesting. The monthly podcast is kind of like a fireside chat.
Yeah. It's myself, Brian Spear, who's the other principal in our group. And then Al Cleef, who's our director of operations. So it's really just three of us. You know, Al gives kind of the update on the operational property management side. I typically, you'll give an update on like the sales and construction. I oversee a lot of the big CapEx projects and also the sales side of our business. And then Brian is more on the investor relations side. And so it's just, again, it's a very high level view. Normally they're about 20 minutes long. And then everything, you know, the bigger report, the quarterly report, is where everything gets, you know, divulged. I mean, all the particular numbers per property, what have you, but we don't go in detail like that on those monthly podcasts, but people love them. They eat them up, and they can also listen to it on their own time. You know, it goes into their portal and they can, it's, you know, it's now it's on demand. They don't have to reach out to us. We're already reaching out to them, and just it's sitting there for whenever they want to learn what's going on with their investment. And we've actually, we keep a watch on it of how many listen to it. We get about a 73% listenership. So it's fairly strong. I mean, I was surprised actually that 73% actually listen to it each and every month.
Okay. How do you track that?
Whatever hosting service we use, and I actually did not set that up, so I do not know, because it's not the same as what we host our normal podcast through. So, but just like I use Libsyn for my podcast, and I can track, you know, how many people are actually downloading it. Whatever hosting Brian set up on our private podcast allows him to track who's downloading which episode and in how many times. And it's only made available to our investors. So like, we know how many investors we have. And so if X number listened to it, then we could easily arrive at a percentage.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I forgot to ask, for mobile home parks, are you using third-party property managers?
No. Unfortunately, that's one of the aspects of the business that probably makes it a little bit more challenging to get into and scale initially. You know, there are some third-party management companies out there, and we've actually tested like the top three and had a horrible experience with all three of them. And so you don't have the luxury like you do in the multifamily space. I think that's one of the big benefits of the multifamily is you can really focus on the acquisition side and finding a good asset and then being a good asset manager, but not necessarily have to build out an entire property management organization, which again, it's one of those unsexy businesses that there's a lot of moving parts and it's not a very profitable business. But however, in the multifamily, they get the luxury of being able to utilize those resources of those big property management companies that exist. Mobile home park space, not so much. And so it makes it challenging when you're buying your first couple of parks, because what you'll find happens is you buy the first park, kind of you're managing yourself. You got an on-site manager, you're kind of managing yourself, and it's maybe taking 15 hours of your time every week. And you buy a second one, now you're taking up 35 hours of your week. And then you buy a third and you're like, holy crap, I just missed my kid's baseball game. I haven't taken my wife out to date night for the last 3 months because I'm literally working now 50 or plus hours a week on these three parks. I want to buy another one, but I don't necessarily have enough additional revenue to pay, like to start hiring staff. You know, I need a property management company. I need to hire a few people, but I can't. And so you go through this limping stage where you slowly are piecing together like staff and you can barely afford it. And it slows down your scaling efforts, what have you. But then at some point you reach a tipping point to where you're hopefully generating enough revenue, paying your property management company enough money where it can actually afford to pay its staff. And that's the tough part of scaling in this particular business and actually having to run two businesses. You're not just running an investment company, you're running a property management company as well. And so our property management company has, I don't know, 40 or 45 employees, you know, full-time employees. And it's in the black, but it's not a profitable endeavor. I'll leave it at that. Like it makes a profit, but it's not a profitable endeavor. I would not own that business if it wasn't a necessity. I wouldn't be in the property management business if it wasn't required. So it makes it, that's one of the unique aspects of our business that I see a lot of new investors, they struggle with, and we did as well. You know, we struggled when we were at that tipping point. It was myself and I had two partners at that time. Now I just have one, but so we had a couple more bodies, able bodies. So we made it to about eight parks and we were like, we're losing our minds. We need to hire people and we need to hire them fast. And we literally couldn't hire them fast enough, but we had to be careful that we didn't overextend and that we only brought in who we could afford and didn't get out ahead of our skis. And so now we're in a better spot.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like that's gotta be a similar difficulty for almost any business. You're just trying to transition yourself out of it and take yourself out of the equation. So.
Yeah. We thought that we would, you know, we went through a deduction process with, we basically researched every property management company that was in the mobile home park space. And there's not a lot of them. There's really not. Maybe when I say legit property management, I'm talking like they manage more than like 10 properties. You know, there's maybe 25 of them throughout the country. And like five of them maybe manage more than 2,000 lots. And the others are, again, they just got a couple small parks here and there. And they're not really a national player. We needed someone that was national because we've got properties in many different states, Northeast, Southeast, and the Midwest. And so it came down to three that had the reach that supposedly had the capacity. And we handed off a few properties to one, a few properties to other, and then a large swath to the one that was supposedly the best in class. And we had a horrific experience with all three of them. It wasn't a pretty experience at all. We brought everything back in and basically, went back to building a stout property management company to manage the assets. And that's where we're at today. And I don't think I'll ever go back down that other road.
Okay. We are running short on time, but what are some of the kind of the nightmares or the big frustrations that you had with these property managers?
Yeah, just, it's hard to nail down just the one, but I'll put it in a little more of a general sense. Like no one's ever going to care for your property as much as you, especially when that individual is the rewarded based on the total revenue, not the total profit that the property produces. And so, one of the big things we saw is the construction expenses on like when we had to turn a unit or do a renovation on a home or do a CapEx project, we were spending more than two times what we would normally have budgeted for the similar project. And it didn't matter to the property management company because they're getting paid on gross revenues. And so for whatever a project costs, it didn't make a difference to them. And in fact, they even got a project, they got a fee, project management fee as well. And so, it's just not an alignment of interest. And I know that it's a pretty standard model, you know, getting paid off of gross revenue. And that's a standard model across the board. I just think that generally speaking, if you have the ability to build your own property management company and you know that business well, and you can get in tune with that business, you could always run your property, whatever type it is, mobile home park, multifamily, even self-storage, better yourself than that of a third party operator. Cause you'll never have a perfect alignment of interest. But the expenses were horrific with some of the operators. In addition to that, even their turn time, when you take a big property management company, for example, the one that was best in class, they manage hundreds of mobile home parks. They actually are really big. They're nationwide. It's like turning a cruise ship. And so, whereas when we have a vacant unit, one that was down, normally we can get that thing turned back around and back on the market for sale within 30 days. With them, the bidding process would take 45 days, and then it'd be another 3 months before we got that thing actually turned back around and on the market. And so it's like turning a cruise ship. Any move you make, it's so slow. Whereas being small, like we are now, like we just manage our own assets, we're agile, and we're looking to cut expenses wherever we can. We're looking to, you know, get the best bid wherever we can. They don't go through that extra effort to do that because they're not encouraged to do so.
Okay. Yeah. It's kind of like banks shopping around for appraisals. I'm like, why would you pay that much for an appraisal? It's ridiculous.
Right. Exactly.
They'll bid it out and say, well, this is just what I got. I'm like, well, I think you could have done better.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so that created a lot of controversy and conflict because, I had known the business well. I mean, I had done enough construction projects. I'm well versed, not just in the mobile home park space, but from being in, you know, owning many other asset types over the years, many other construction projects I've been involved in. I know how to estimate what, you know, road asphalt patching should be, you know, based on the size of the patches, what have you. I know what a normal turn should be in a unit when we got to put just paint and carpet and minor cosmetics. I know what all those things are. And so when you try to serve me a dish that is three times the amount of what normal is, I have a challenge with that, and it creates a conflict. And so we went through, you know, a lot of headbutting as well, which is not a healthy relationship. And so it wasn't healthy for them. It wasn't healthy for us. And ultimately decided that, you know, within the first like 4 months that we were going to have to build this in-house in a big way. And ultimately we did that. It took us about 6 months to truly build what our property management company is today, which is we wanted to build it to where it could not only handle the assets we own at present, but also if we went and bought 10 more parks, 20 more parks in the next year or two, that it would be able to expand along with it. And we had the right talent at the helm to manage that expansion. And so that's where we're at today. So we're probably a little overbuilt, but we're starting on a acquisition streak here now and looking to utilize that overbuilt property management company that we have now.
Okay. Sounds good. So definitely running short on time now. I got to run to another call, but the last question is, I noticed on your website, you're a huge craft beer enthusiast, as am I. So what is like your go-to? Are you like a porter or ale guy or black lager?
Depends what kind of mood I'm in. Seriously, like right now, it really does. I'm all over the board. Like right now in my fridge, I've got like an Imperial Stout. I've got some Belgian beers. And I've got some sours. I've got a couple of pilsners in there. I mean, like it's like the entire range. So it really depends on the day, how I'm feeling, what my palate's telling me. And so I'm all over the place. I like everything. About the only thing that I'm not a huge fan of are typically like wheat beers. And I don't even like sours all that much, but I've gotten into some more of the, you know, darker age sours. A couple of my buddies own some breweries and they've got me into some more, I guess, higher end sours. And so I'm coming to like them now as well. So I like beer in general. I like different flavor profiles, and I like basically pairing it with the mood that I'm in at that point in time.
Okay. It makes a lot of sense.
How about yourself? What's your go-to?
It's actually similar, but usually I'll ask, like if we go to bars, like what porters and stouts do you have on draft? If I'm just looking to, so a lot of times I'll start out the first drink with a strong beer like that, and I might scale back to like an ale later, and then maybe if, like a Bud Light if I'm like on the ground. But you know, I try not to drink too much. Actually, I haven't drinking recently anyway, so
yeah,
it's interesting. So, yeah, it's, you know, play both sides.
I used to be on the hobby kick for a long time, and so, for like a year or two ago, I still enjoy hops, but I don't go after like double IPAs or, you know, I might just drink a pale ale, but like it, I'm not as attracted to those incredibly hoppy flavors as I used to be, which is weird. I don't know what changed. And we're on the boat this weekend. It's funny. We spent a lot of time in the water and out in the sun and all that, which, you know, the craft beer enthusiasts that are listening to this are going to like, you know, fall into their grave, is that I literally had Coors Light with me because it was just easy and it was really light and it's like water. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you're going for like a trip where it's kind of a marathon, you have to do that. Like my dad just drinks Keystone Lights and it gave me a headache, but I, you know, he's sitting there like he's like on his ranch. He's just drinking throughout the day. So it's just like water. So it makes
right,
sense.
Right.
Especially if you're in the sun, you don't want to have like super heavy beers with this everything.
Exactly.
On you. But all right. Good stuff. And then Running for Bruce. I know you started that, but what are you, it's like a charitable organization. Is it the funds going to something?
Yeah. So we Running for Brews is that actually came out of the real estate crash 2008. I kind of took a 3-year hiatus away from real estate as I managed damage control with everything that was going on. And I really turned and focused on my health and fitness and my well-being even more than what I had prior. I've always been fairly conscious of you know, living a healthy lifestyle, but I really turned completely towards that. And I got into running in a big way, and I wanted to pair running and craft beer, which are two of my loves. I wanted to turn into a business. It was more of a social environment initially. And then ultimately we found a way to monetize it and do good with it. And so Running for Brewers, I've lost count of the chapters. I think we've got like 43 or 44 chapters across the country. I'm not really involved that much any longer. I'm still an owner, but I kind of passed the buck about 4 years ago. To someone I had brought in as a partner, and they kind of managed the ship. But so depending on the location, we got them in different states, you know, lots here in Florida, but we've got them up in, you know, Michigan, we've got them in Virginia, Texas. I know we have a few, and we let the local chapter organizer, you know, find a charity that's near and dear to their heart. And then we'll do like, you know, 5K runs outside of our weekly social run. We'll do like 5K events on a weekend, or we'll do like a food drive, shirt donations, things like that, and find charities that are near and dear to the organizer's heart and pass it along. And so there's not only one charity. I don't know how many we've helped over the years, but it's been a cool experience and just a way for people to meet each other. Lots of marriages have happened now from the Running for Brews meetups that happen on a weekly basis at different craft beer bars across the country. So it's a fun thing. And I haven't been to one of the runs for the last couple of years, but I still run a bunch. I just don't go. I've got kids now, younger kids. And so going to a 7 p.m. run and drinking beer on a weeknight doesn't really fit my agenda these days.
Yeah, that makes sense. Interest and habits, everything change. All right. So last question, what's the best way for our listeners to learn more about what you're doing and get in touch with you?
Yeah. So you can go to my personal website, which is kevinbupp.com, and you can find out different things that we've got going on. I actually host one of my two podcasts on that website, which is Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow. So again, kevinbupp.com. And then my company website, if you want to learn what we're doing in the mobile home park space, you can go to sunrisecapitalinvestors.com. And on either one of those websites, you can use the contact us page and, you know, get in touch with myself or one of the other partners in the group.
Perfect. Well, thanks again for your time. This is all very interesting. I think we could probably talk all day, but we all got stuff to do. So we'll do it again next time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Mason. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Likewise.